Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Anchorage gynecologist, Dr. Tina Thompson. And what we are trying to accomplish today is really help our listeners understand a little bit better about the current recommendations for pap smears. While we're doing this, we should help everybody understand a little bit better about the causes and prevention of cervical cancer, and in particular, a vaccine that has the potential for decreasing at least 70% of all cervical cancer. If you have questions or comments during the next hour or so, you can reach us at our local number. That's 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email us during the next hour at line1. You have to spell that out, all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Tina, it's wonderful to have you back. Thanks for offering to do this for us.
Well, I'm kind of nervous. I don't have anybody with me here today except you, by golly.
I will do my best to help you feel more comfortable. So let's start with one of your primary passions, pap smears. Why don't you tell us a little bit, what the heck is a pap smear anyway? Let's get to the basics.
Well, George Papanicolaou was a doctor, I guess, and back in 1928, he reported this system for obtaining cells from the vagina or cervix of women. He'd done some studies, I think, on guinea pigs and, as I understand it, even his own wife, and then eventually on prostitutes. But he figured out that you could extract cells off the cervix and find cancerous changes. And it was really proven and published in 1941 that they could do a pap smear to find cervical cancer. And since then, it's basically become kind of standard. In our country, certainly, it's been yearly pap smears forever. Where we have fallen down in cervical cancer screening was in populations where people didn't get pap smears or didn't get them often enough. And so I think it's particularly interesting now that we've collected so much science over the last several decades that they've come up with new guidelines, and it's kind of confusing as to why they would go from yearly pap smears to less frequent and how we could do as well or better, which is actually why I contacted you and wanted to go on the air, because I was trying to explain that over and over and thought this would be a good venue.
Yeah. So as information moves on, we've got more and more information, and we'll get around to that issue that you want to make sure that we address, and that's that women are confused about why things are changing after being doing it yearly. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit more. So the lining of the cervix can be scraped away fairly non-invasively, and then what happens with those cells? What happens with those? Where does it go? How do we examine that? How does it help us know what's going on?
Well, the way a pap smear is collected is you usually use a little bit of a spatula on the cervix, around the outside, reaching up in the canal. There are different little mechanisms. But in the old days, we used to just smear them on a slide and spray them. You could even spray them with hairspray. And then the poor pathologist, had to see through all the mucus and, the piles of cells and stuff like that. And they did a pretty darn good job. But in the last 10 years or so, several companies have developed liquid-based pap smears. So now we take all those cells and just stick them in a little tiny jug of liquid, which is the fixative. And then they have machinery that takes those cells and spreads them out beautifully on a slide. So the pathologists are dancing around their chairs. They can't believe they get such beautiful slides. The detection rate of changes in cancer is not any different. But the advantage with the liquid-based is we don't have to have people come back because we got an inadequate sample or because there were some blood cells from their menstrual cycle or some problem like that. We can use lubricants and, the machinery gets rid of that.
So the pathologist is a physician who's trained to look at these cells, and ideally they kind of want a very simple, spread out, non-contaminated, very easy to look at bunch of cells that they look at for particular changes, which lets them know that these are cells that are suspiciously abnormal, becoming precancerous, cancer. I mean, so changes in particular can help them grade that. Am I I'm guessing because I don't do these, but that's my understanding.
Right,
is that right.
They read the pap smears out as, you know, you can get a pap smear read out as cancer. This is mm-hmm. invasive cancer mm-hmm. or suspicious for cancer or suspicious for carcinoma in situ mm-hmm. on down the road. We actually often lump together moderate and severe dysplasia and even carcinoma in situ into high-grade changes. And then there's mild changes, and then there's kind of a minimally abnormal pap smear that's often read out as atypical squamous cells of undetermined significance. There's an atypical glandular cell categorization. But basically, when they're looking at the cells, they're guessing at which category to put in. Guessing was not the right word. Mm-hmm. Highly trained and stuff. But we know that there is a little variation from pathologist to pathologist, and from they can read the same slide slightly differently each time. And that kind of thing. So, but there's a, and you know, it's, you know, one thing that's fascinating is that if you read that book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, Rebecca Skloot, back in those days, which I think it was in the 50s or 60s, they didn't actually even connect dysplasia to cancer. Huh. So they could tell the difference between normal and invasive cancer, but they didn't actually know that dysplasia was a precursor to cancer.
So there's a transient phenomenon. I want to make sure if I say something today, I am not a cancer specialist, but I think of cancer as something that evolves over time. It's not there one minute and gone and not the next. That there has to be a number of changes that take time to develop.
Well, hold your horses. That depends on which cancer you're talking about, but certainly in the case mm-hmm. of cervical cancer, that's true.
Okay.
So cervical cancer, colon cancer, you know, maybe breast cancers. There are a lot of cancers in the body that develop slowly, mm-hmm. but there are probably some that just blast out the starting gate and mm-hmm. go crazy. Mm-hmm. But this is definitely one of the slow ones. In fact, it probably takes as long to develop cervical cancer as colon cancer. And, you know, I mean, when we're talking about the new guidelines, who'd put up with a colonoscopy every year?
So how accurate has the pap smear become? What's the evidence that it's been successful at controlling cervical cancer?
Worldwide, cervical cancer is the largest cause of death of any kind of cancer in women, period. And particularly if you look, for instance, at the continent of Africa, cervical cancer is very deadly. They don't, if you then move to countries that have started pap screening programs of any type of any frequency, you can plummet the rate of cervical cancer deaths and the number of cervical cancer cases mm-hmm. as well, because when they realize that they can find things in a precancerous state. So that's the best evidence.
Okay. All right. And I guess the part of the reason for that is that you can, that if it's a slow-growing cancer, it can go for a long time before it causes symptoms enough that someone's going to do something about it often, kind of like pancreatic cancer is said to be a problem because it can be there for a long time before you really know you've got a problem. Is that somewhat the reason for the cervical cancer causing such a high mortality rate?
Correct. After all, the cervix is, you know, you'd have to take a look at it.
Right.
We'd have those duckbill speculums and that kind of thing. But if you're in a resource-poor country that doesn't do that routinely, mm-hmm. doesn't have a program, doesn't have trained people, then a cervix might never get a look-see.
And even if you have the ability, you've got to go in and look in a periodic way to see if it takes a long time to develop these changes that might be precancerous that we pick up on a pap smear have been there for a long time. So even if you look and you don't do a pap smear, you may not see anything. And several years later, you've got
some
serious problems.
Absolutely. You know, the early changes, the stages of dysplasia are usually, you know, microscopic and mm-hmm. not visible to the naked eye. Mm-hmm. You know, an invasive cancer might be visible to the naked eye, but the early stages are certainly not. And they're reversible. I mean, that's what we do.
In the U.S., it's my understanding that cervical cancer prevalence, the amount of cervical cancer in the United States is slowly decreasing, as well as death rates also. Is that true?
Yeah, over the years, we have done a good job at getting cervical cancer rates down. It has kind of leveled off, and actually the best thing that since sliced bread, I might say, has been that HPV vaccine. There are two of them out: the Gardasil and the Cervarix. But those HPV vaccines bring the hope of driving cervical cancer rates even further down.
Who is at risk of developing cervical cancer?
Everybody with a cervix.
Okay.
Frankly, not completely. A person who remains a virgin for a lifetime is not at risk. We think, after all, that it's somewhere around 99% of cervical cancers are from HPV viruses, and they're basically sexually transmitted. But, you know, if you think about it, they've done studies of all kinds, whether it's pap smears to try to detect HPV or biopsies or anything, and probably somewhere between 70 and 80% of us in a lifetime will be exposed to HPV viruses sexually. So it's very ubiquitous. You know, it's like trying to go to a elementary school, spend any time, and get away without a head cold.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Tina Thompson. And what we're talking about primarily is pap smears. We've already kind of discussed a little bit of the history of those tests for cervical cancer. So we're also talking about cervical cancer, its prevention and risk factors. And we're going to eventually talk about something called the human papillomavirus at some greater length. But at any point during today's program, if you have questions or comments, don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. You can email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So you said that the old recommendations were yearly pap smears, if I'm remembering right. What's the correct?
They basically, developed this. They said, we've got this test and we know how to use it. How often should we do it? Oh, maybe, how about every year?
Right.
And it was pretty easy to do. You know, it's not like a colonoscopy. It doesn't require sedation and all kinds of stuff. But it's been over the... And we did a good job, you know, with yearly pap smears. We've done a great job at bringing down cervical cancer death rates, what a successful program. So how could you change that? I mean, why would you? What's happened is, over the last couple of decades, we first of all connected the dots between the precancerous dysplasia and cancer, and then we connected the dots with the HPV virus and the dysplasia. Then we developed a test for the HPV virus, and we looked at the life... You know, the lifespan of cervical dysplasia and how long it takes. So it can take about 10 years to develop cervical invasive cancer, even from moderate dysplasia. So they looked at the science of the pap smears, and what we realized we were doing is finding a lot of minor HPV-related mild dysplasia in young women, particularly, kind of over-treating that. And what we really wanted to do was good testing, less frequently, so we didn't find ourselves over-treating women too much, but still find what we need to.
So the recommendations have modified based on this increasing information that you just elicited that changed things. So what's the current recommendation?
So the current recommendations make several very important changes. First of all, no pap smears in women younger than 21. Cervical cancer can happen to women younger than 21, but it's so rare, it's more rare than men's breast cancer, and we don't make them get mammograms. Starting at 21, women should get pap smears every 3 years. And for screening, don't test for HPV. You'd like to have them vaccinated, of course, but you don't need to know if they have acquired an HPV virus. You're going to assume that their immune system will get it under control, and you're just screening for significant abnormal pap smears, for abnormal cells, every 3 years until 30. And at 30, from 30 to 65, you can continue that pap smear every 3 years, or you can do a pap smear with the HPV test, that is the high-risk HPV screen, every 5 years. And if a woman has a normal pap smear, that is normal cytology, no abnormal cells, and a negative HPV test, that is such a good result that you can rely on that for 5 years. The chance that that woman will have moderate or severe dysplasia that has missed detection is so low that you can cruise for 5 years.
Okay.
And then you get to graduate if you meet criteria at 65.
I want to come back to some of this because I think we need to, in my mind, we got to delve out or clarify what HPV is and how it's related and all that. But quickly, let me ask you why you don't need to do them anymore after 65.
A woman would continue to get pap smears after 65 only if she hasn't been adequately papped in the previous 20 years, at least 2 to 3 pap smears every mm-hmm. decade. You know, in somewhere about 1990, Medicare started paying for pap smears. And it was because at that time they realized that something like 40% of women over 60 had not had any paps.
Okay.
So it can be paid for. But the thing is that in a well-papped group of women who haven't been treated for moderate or severe dysplasia in the previous 20 years and have been well-papped, they will not enjoy any survival advantage by getting pap smears after 65.
It's not likely to cause them significant.
Correct.
Bad outcomes and because of the slow nature of these changes.
Right. A car is going to hit them or something else.
We've had this discussion on this program about the changes and recommendations for mammogram and the changes and recommendations for prostate screening, prostate antigen, PSAs. And one of the little ringers in all that is that you, for example, you could have a mammogram that's completely normal. Everybody reads it's normal. You can have a PSA that's completely normal, and you could be dead in a year from breast cancer or prostate cancer because there are outlier cancers that are extremely aggressive, and the screening tests will miss them. Is that true for cervical cancer also? No, that's the bad luck of the deal. I mean, there is those very aggressive cancers. I just thought I'd ask the same question about cervical cancer.
I think the answer is practically no.
Okay.
Practically no. I think the reason why everybody wishes they had a pap smear for their particular disease is because we have been more successful with pap smears, and I think that's because cervical cancer, for the most part, in the vast majority, is a slow-growing HPV-related disease. That can't be said of 20% of breast cancers, and it can't be said of 15% of colon cancers or whatever. So,
okay, all right, Lucy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I wanted to ask about DES exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Cervical cancer risks as a woman ages. I've now had breast cancer along with the clear cell cervical cancer when I was 20 and 21.
And you were exposed through your mother to DES?
Yes, she was given DES when she was pregnant with me in 1958.
Mm-hmm. Tina, would you explain what the DES is and what she's asking?
Yeah, DES is diethyl stilbestrol, which is an estrogen product that was used, prescribed for a lot of women to decrease miscarriage rates. And basically over the years, we have never found any way to decrease miscarriage rates safely. We've tried several things and caused a lot of harm. DES was used to try to support pregnancies and reduce miscarriage rates. It was found, though, and I think it was in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a large cohort of bizarre vaginal adenocarcinomas. So there were young women who suddenly had vaginal adenocarcinomas. This was reported, and they discovered on review that these women had been exposed in utero to DES. So the whole DES daughters thing exploded, and women like yourself then were looked at very carefully, colposcopies, screens, and that kind of thing to try to find any of these adenocarcinomas. And what happened was during embryologic development, some of the glandular tissue that would have normally been up in the Mullerian tract that forms the uterus and that kind of thing was sometimes spattered in the vagina or on the cervix. And and some unusual cancers developed. The interesting thing now is that not only does is DES exposure an exclusion for the new criteria, but scientists are not quite sure what to recommend now. You see, women who were DES exposed have largely moved on in age, and it seems that the bulk of disease that they were going to suffer from may be in their past. We are still not quite sure what to make of a DES woman, a DES exposed daughter who is, and it sounds like you're about my age, but largely we were worried about those very young cancers. And that was, if you escape that, it may be that, you know, you can look worry and see worry in the rearview mirror.
Okay.
So, so you said you had cervical cancer in your 20s?
Yes.
Yeah, which we've already, if I'm hearing Tina right, is a very unusual situation.
Correct.
And you had exposure potentially through your mother to diethylsilbestrol, and I'm sure that was assumed to be part of the reasons for that. But then you also said you've gone ahead and developed breast cancer?
Yes, and there is a DES action, a nationwide organization, and I was not aware of them until after I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and genetic counseling provided us. I wasn't sure about if I had enough information on my father's side of his, you know, his family, the females.
Right.
But the genetic counselor said there was no need to test for a BRCA gene because I had enough information, and most likely my breast cancer was from the DES exposure.
Ah,
and I do understand that they are now studying the third generation.
Okay.
But I know we never hear very much about that. And it's something I feel strongly about, and my GYN, besides a pap, I don't get a regular pap smear. She takes cells from vaginally also, and they said, they just recently told us to continue those as we age, that you're at risk for some more.
Right, that's basically it's unknown waters.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it doesn't hurt to be extra careful, though.
Right.
I like to get the word out to people because so many people don't know about that.
Yeah, no, I think that, to me, that's interesting. The reason I brought it up and wanted to ask the questions a little bit more is because of the recognition subsequently to understanding diethylsilbestrol is how we've recognized that there are very important genetic mechanisms that we use to clean up errors in our own genetic makeup. We're making mistakes all the time as we remake cells and DNA, and people who have BRCA1, BRCA2 deficiencies are more likely to have cancer. So I was saying, you know, I wonder if there's other things. So I was going to encourage at least thinking about that other option. And the other thing that I think we now know is we've gotten into this whole issue of what's called epigenetics. And that is a situation where exposures to environmental factors actually change markers on our DNA, not the DNA, that are inheritable, so that it could be multi-generational. I am not saying that DES exposure is one of those factors, but it at least has some, in my mind, some clinical rationale why you may want to continue to follow offspring for a while. Without getting too deep, have you heard anything like that, Lucy?
Well, I know the ramifications for the third generation grandchildren are much higher for female granddaughters,
mm-hmm.
And I have sons, and they were not affected. So,
okay.
For that.
All right. Well, thanks.
But anyway, I was just curious as far as with the. Because I heard the after 65, so
right.
That was all.
Right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your call. You have any other comments, Tina?
No, not really. No.
She wants to.
Another exclusion from the new guidelines is women who have HIV.
Okay.
You know, so if you're immune compromised and stuff like that, where you might expect that an HPV might cause more problems, and women who have solid organ transplants, kidney transplants, who are immunosuppressed to keep their.
Well, what about women who have BRCA1 or BRCA2? I mean, usually those are ovarian and breast cancer. Do you know off the top of your head, are those women recommended to have yearly exams or not?
No. That doesn't change cervical cancer frequency.
Okay. So here's an email that came in. It says, women who've had a hysterectomy, are they still, is it suggested for them to have pap smears?
Depends on the reason for the hysterectomy. If a woman had a hysterectomy for cervical cancer or for moderate or severe dysplasia, then the general recommendation is to continue with vaginal pap smears for 20 years, although we do recognize that vaginal pap smears aren't particularly good at finding things. If the hysterectomy was for benign conditions and the woman had not ever had any moderate, severe, or carcinoma in situ or cancer, then no, done with paps.
All right. Why don't we take this opportunity just to take our mid-course break here. And let me remind listeners one more time, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. Our local number, once again, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a minute break, and then we'll continue our conversation with Anchorage gynecologist Dr. Tina Thompson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're discussing pap smears in particular with Dr. Tina Thompson of the Anchorage Women's Clinic. But we're also going to move on a little bit into cause and prevention of cervical cancer. But if you've got questions or comments about pap smears, which we've had a couple of excellent ones, or other information you have questions about relating to the cause of prevention, you can email us over the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. A couple of other comments. Just remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, so we won't be able to help you with questions during that period of time. But at any time, you can go to www.alaskapublic.org and look for the Line 1 archives and listen to the program at any time. You can refer somebody who you think should listen to the program to go to that archive and listen to this program or others that we've done in the past. So, Tina, back to pap smears a little bit. You have mentioned that there are guidelines. Where do those things come from? Who makes the guidelines?
Yeah, so these changes, you know, the way I describe it is that a few years ago, different groups came up with different ideas about mammogram guidelines, for example, and brawls broke out in the streets because nobody could agree. The very cool thing about the pap smear guidelines is that there's a group called the ASCCP, American Society for Colposcopic and Cervical Pathology, and they really have driven the science on pap pap smears and stuff like that. And they really looked at a lot of the science that's been collected over the last 5 to 10 years. They did some additional studies down in Kaiser Permanente, and they came up with these new guidelines that were based on so much science that basically all the groups involved have lined up and said, yeah, we're in. So no brawling in the streets. We've been all thrilled with these new guidelines.
So the evidence is pretty much overwhelming that the based on the current understanding of cervical cancer and how the testing that we're doing now, how it works, is that there's relatively universal agreement on how the recommendations is what I hear you saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And those could change with new information.
Sure. But they're so science-based. It's mm-hmm. been just delightful.
I asked you before, who was at risk? Are there particularly higher risk women, groups of women, who might be, you want to be more careful about this?
Well, you know, like I told you, women who are immunosuppressed, mm-hmm. solid organ transplant women, HIV. But among women who aren't immunosuppressed, smokers. Smokers have twice the rate of dysplasia and cancerous changes. And I have kind of a mechanical visual mind. The way I explain it is that if you're smoking, your immune system's busy in your lungs trying to clean up the mess. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take care of your cervix because it's too busy. Mm-hmm. So that's a significant concern. We think, and we have long thought, that smoking was a cofactor in HPV disease. And I think the new information that comes out about oropharyngeal cancers being related to HPV kind of ties in with that. When I was in medical school, it was largely thought to be mostly a smoking-related or smoking and drinking-related kinds of cancers, but they have in the last just couple of years connected the dots with HPV 16 and 18, particularly in oropharyngeal cancers. And when you look at the new data, man, it makes you realize how much men are at risk as well. So
you really want to get to this HPV, and I'm going to hold you up here just a second again. We'll get there. What about symptoms of cervical cancer? So I'm saying here, women in the past have been going and getting them pretty quickly, pretty regularly, but there are women who may not be that regular. What are the kinds of symptoms, if any, that might alert a woman that she really needs to get an exam?
If a woman were to have symptoms from cervical cancer, they're likely to be late. If every now and then we can still find a cancer that otherwise would be undetectable from abnormal bleeding, and then pain. Cervical cancer is the type of cancer that doesn't tend to spread widely to, say, lungs or brain or someplace like that. It'll creep locally. So cervical cancer will end up causing pain as the tumor encroaches on adjacent organs.
Okay. What about treatable? So we're doing these screens to see if we can detect cervical cancer, particularly hopefully early. What are your options depending on the findings on the pap smears, treatment-wise?
And with the guidelines, we're really trying to reduce the number of people we treat because we know that women who have mild dysplasia, often their body can get that under control and even eliminate it. So we'd like to not over-treat mild dysplasia. But the treatments that we have, if a woman has mostly moderate and severe dysplasia, are largely in-office procedures, either freezing, which has been around forever, or currently a LEAP procedure. And just the other week, I read a new article about Imiquimod being used topically as a suppository, but that's not mm-hmm. out for publication. Mm-hmm. It was a fascinating article, though.
It's an anti-wart medication.
Anti-wart medication, right, used as a vaginal suppository.
Will become clearer in a minute when I let Tina talk about HPV. But anyway.
Right. But the freezing is basically we use a nitrous tank hooked up to a small metal tip, hold it against the cervix and give it a good case of frostbite, let it thaw, do it again. So we get a really good case of frostbite. And then as the body gets rid of that surface and heals it over, then you can get rid of, it has about a 70 70 to 80% cure rate, which is the same as a LEAP procedure. A LEAP procedure is where we use a electrified wire wand and take kind of the front surface off of the cervix as if I was taking off the tip of your nose.
All right, so now we're going to move on, I think, to talk about human papillomavirus, HPV, which...
Well, wait a minute, I want to go back.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So those are for dysplasia that are office procedures.
Okay, so we didn't finish treatment. Okay.
Right. So for an early case of invasive cancer, a woman might need a hysterectomy, specifically a radical hysterectomy. And a radical hysterectomy is done by a gynecologic oncologist, and they will reach out and get lymph nodes and some adjacent tissue besides the uterus and cervix. So they do kind of a broad hysterectomy. And then if it's more invasive than just a radical hysterectomy, there are still excellent cure rates with a combination of usually chemotherapy and radiation, or one or the other or both. But so cures can be achieved up until, I don't know, stage 3 or 4. But I think one of the pushes for reducing too much early treatment is if you treat a cervix too much when it's young, it may pucker up, and then you may not be able to get to the disease that can grow then inside the cervix.
In the canal, heading up towards the uterus, where it's not as easy to see or look at.
We want access to that canal, right? So now you were asking what HPV?
All right, so where we want to head, I think we're going to agree that we want to head now, is we now have the potential to prevent a lot of cervical cancer in a whole different way. And that relates to the fact that there's very, very good evidence now that cervical cancer is caused by a virus.
Correct? Absolutely. It's okay. The connections between the HPV virus and cervical cancer are stronger than between smoking and lung cancer. It's just a done deal. And we've, as they've been able to detect the HPV virus, then we know now that although the what we call the squamous columnar junction on the cervix is the favorite HPV playground, that there are all kinds of other organs that are at risk. The vagina, the vulva, the oropharynx, the anus in women, although cervix still is a majority. And in men, there's penile, anal, and oropharyngeal cancers. So currently, men have, there's some data from the CDC, 2005 to 2009, men had 12,000 HPV-related cancers. Women had 20,000 HPV-related cancers, and the total was 32,000. Clearly, everybody needs some prevention. And I always love saying that prevention is even better than early diagnosis. And early diagnosis is better than late diagnosis. So who wouldn't love prevention?
So the human papillomavirus, I'm going to throw out a little bit of my understanding of the human papillomavirus. And so viruses are the things, organisms like the viruses that cause colds and cause HIV, a human immunodeficiency virus. So these are very, very, very tiny organisms that infect cells and can lead to significant changes. One group of these viruses is called human papillomavirus, and there's about 150 different, let's say, subtypes or serotypes of that particular virus. And almost common warts, are caused by different types of human papillomavirus. In fact, the medical term for a wart is a papilloma. That's how these things got named. And they infect surfaces, mucous membranes, that's inside your mouth. That thing that's inside your mouth is a mucous membrane. The outside of our body is covered by skin. But they infect those cells, and they cause warts. But a couple of strains, particularly number 16 and number 18, are the ones we're talking about today that cause changes in the cervix of women that begin to start the process towards cancer. And not all women, my understanding is not every woman who gets exposed to human papillomavirus in 16, 18, goes ahead and develop cancer. But if you turn around and you look at all women who have cancer, they're caused by 16 or 18 plus a handful of others. Is that the way you understand this?
Correct. Correct. If I could only have one HPV test, the single test that we can do for 16 and 18 would be the most valuable. What we currently use largely, and when I talked about the guidelines for women between 30 and 65, and I talked about HPV testing, what we're talking about are there are a few organizations or companies that have made HPV tests for the high-risk HPVs, and they test for a panel of 13 or 14 high-risk HPVs that have ever been found in cervical cancer. But cervical cancer, largely, what in 70% of those, you find 16 and 18. 16 and 18, they're the real troublemakers. They're the gang leaders.
And these viruses, which we may have not said directly, are ubiquitous. And ubiquitous means they're everywhere. There's hardly a child in the United States that doesn't have a wart at some time in their life. And most of these don't end up with anything. Your body takes care of them. And a certain percentage of age 16 and 18s go away without any particular problems. But some go ahead and cause problems. And what you don't want to do is, or what you're trying to do is prevent people from getting infections with number 16 and 18. And so there are now two vaccines that at least cover for 16 and 18 and plus a couple of other strains of HPV that are associated with genital warts that are present. So that gets us to this level of prevention using a vaccine.
You bet. Right. The Cervarix vaccine covers 16 and 18, and the Gardasil vaccine covers 6/11, 16 and 18. And 6/11 are the viruses that have been found in 90% of venereal warts.
All right. And so one of the principles of immunization is you got to get your immune system to think it's been infected before it actually gets infected to work. So here's an email from a listener. It says, my daughter hasn't had the HPV vaccine and is now 21. She's had five or six sexual partners, most of whom have never had sex before. Would the HPV vaccine still be beneficial for her? And I'm going to add a question that she didn't ask. Is there any way to tell for sure whether she's had 16 or 18 infection yet with HPV 16 or 18?
We don't routinely screen for the viruses. There is theoretic literature about using viral screening instead of pap smears, but that's beyond the scope of this program. She may, if indeed, I'll get back to that, if indeed all of her partners were virgins, then she's basically still likely to be an HPV virgin, and yes, she should be vaccinated right away, right away. That's the point, and that's why they recommend the vaccine to young kids when they're, you know, 9 to 11, is because you'll get by far the best outcomes if you can vaccinate people when they're virgins. There was a study in, I think, Costa Rica where they took all 18-year-olds, and they did actually do a test for a virus. And 16, 18, I think, is what they were testing for. And then they vaccinated them, and they followed them thereafter. And the ones who were positive at the time of vaccine for 16 and 18 got no benefit from the vaccine because they were either going to or not going to develop a cervical dysplasia, whereas the ones that had not been exposed who were virally negative at the start did get a benefit from the vaccine.
All right, so let's ask the question a little bit differently. So she's 21, she's never had HPV, she's already had sexual partners, which we don't know the history of realistically. If she was my daughter, I would tell her to get the HPV vaccine as soon as possible. Would you agree, or would you do something different?
Oh, no, I would absolutely agree. And, you know,
so there's no risk to getting it, even if you've already been exposed to hepatitis or human papillomavirus number 16 and 18. There's no reason why you can't get the vaccine. It's not going to do anything.
Correct.
And since it's really, from a practical standpoint, not easy to be sure, do it.
Correct.
Right?
It's not like it's a heat-seeking missile and your body's going to blow up. No,
Yeah.
Not like that.
Right.
And And in fact, the vaccine has been out since 2006. The first one, the Gardasil, has been out since 2006. And it was tested before that, actually, at the University of Washington. And so it's been out for a good decade. And the side effects are basically that it stings a little bit, and sometimes teenagers faint. So, you know, we developed in our clinic a routine of keeping Gardasil vaccinees there for 15 minutes so they didn't walk down the hall and keel over at the elevator. But that's basically been it. There have been no, they've reported complications and stuff like that to the through the usual channels. And as compared to a group vaccinated with placebo or unvaccinated, there's been no increased incidence of, you know, liver failure or death or any serious problems.
So here's another question. Once you've had the HPV vaccine or the other vaccine made by GlaxoSmithKline, I know, but I can't remember the name.
Cervarix.
Mm-hmm. What's the recommendation for pap smears then?
Same as I just said.
Okay. And the reason for that is the vaccines do not cover all the potential causes of cervical, all the particular HPV types that cause cancer.
Correct. Okay. Now, if you could give us a population of 100% vaccinated when they were virginal women, then we might, you know, be able to do 20 years of studies and say, oh, okay, let's change the cervical cancer screening a little further. But for the current time, we know in America that that we've only got a 40% vaccination rate at best. It's, frankly, it's embarrassing. In fact, a friend of mine who's a gynecologic oncology doctor was at an international gynecologic cancer meeting, and he said that the people from the other countries were kind of pointing and laughing in America because we've got such bad vaccination rates.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. We're talking with Tina Thompson, an Anchorage gynecologist. Right now we're talking about the HPV vaccine that helps prevent cervical cancer in women. If you've got concerns about why you should not get that vaccine, this would be a good time to call and get some information out. There has been an unusual amount of apparent lack of immunization in this country that Dr. Thompson just mentioned. It'd be nice to get some of those reasons discussed if we have the time. Kathy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I have a general question. Dr. Turner said that you don't need a pap smear until you're 21. I have a 15-year-old daughter. When should she first see an OBGYN doc?
Oh, what I always tell moms in my practice is that what you want to do is make sure that your daughter has got access to STD screening or STD information prevention and access to contraception. Those things are what she needs. It may not be from an OBGYN. It may be from her pediatric nurse practitioner or pediatrician, or it may be at the municipality clinic or almost anything. But you want to make sure that she's just got access to those practitioners. And what I sometimes tell my patients is to go home and say, you know, I saw the gynecologist today, and, you know, your daughter will roll her eyes. And then you say, and I asked her about you, you know, and then they really roll their eyes. And she said you didn't need a pap smear yet, you know, but what you do need is access to this. And they'll, you know, leave in a huff. But at some point, because you brought it up, they may come back and say, hey, you said I could see somebody if I wanted to. Could I really? You know, and that's the way it'll work.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Kathy. The person who emailed earlier about her daughter that was 21 and had some sexual partners and never received HPV and wanted to know if she should get the HPV vaccine also wrote in and says, what if her partners wasn't a virgin? She had said earlier that none of the partners were positive. And I would answer that question is, I don't believe anybody who says anything about sex. It's not necessarily, and that's not even the point here. I would say, and again, Tina, you may disagree, but I know of at least one pediatric study where girls were asked if they had ever had sexual intercourse and then were tested for HPV virus, and were certain percentage of them were positive. Now, one, they could not be telling us the truth. Two, this virus is everywhere. They could have self-infected themselves putting a tampon in, for example. So, and there are other things people do during sex besides intercourse that could spread these things. So these viruses are everywhere. You don't know if you've got them. You're never going to eradicate all of them. And you need to get vaccinated to prevent yourself from getting these things.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
All right.
They're really ubiquitous.
Yep. That's really the point, is not really. I think if your sexual partners are much more sexually active, the risk is there. But boys are going to have the HPV vaccine potentially and spread it, but they're not going to have symptoms either.
You know, I remember fascinating study that I read years ago. What they did was they went to a college campus and they said, did you ever lie to a partner to get in their pants? And the girls said, oh, yeah, about 50% of the girls had lied. And what was the most common lie that they said? Well, they said that they were on pills. And then they asked the guys, how many of you have ever lied to a partner? And the 75% of the guys had lied. And what lie had you told them? Well, the lie they told them was that they were a virgin. So, you know, so they didn't need to, you know, protect against STDs. So, you know, and that was I've never forgotten that study.
Yeah. But what I want people to hear, and if I'm right, and again, I'm pretty sure about this, that's not the issue.
The issue is
the potential is there for infection for all of us, and we have the ability to safely prevent this from happening.
Yeah.
And at least 70% of the cases now with a very effective, very safe vaccine. We need to get a better vaccine that protects against more, and we need to get more people vaccinated.
Right. And, you know, it's a little bit like, so here's my latest analogy. It's like a car. So you've got your teenager. They're learning to drive. They get the best driver. They're in the safest car. They're driving only on Wednesday when there's nobody on the road, and they've got airbags surrounding them everywhere. You still want them to wear a seatbelt. You know, and the HPV vaccine is like a seatbelt. You know, it's you want them to be as safe and cautious and careful as possible. But, you know, things do happen and you end up in the ditch. And a seatbelt is you would not want them driving without a seatbelt.
Susan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, Dr. Thompson. It's good to hear you on the show. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about the immunization. I mean, this is something that will save women's lives. I've been a public health social worker, and I am now an oncology social worker.
Oh, good
and
for you.
I'm an oncology social worker because I'm a nearly 25-year survivor of adenocarcinoma of the cervix.
Uh-huh.
And I was really glad that you mentioned the risk factor of smoking. I was not a smoker. And I actually paid to have myself to do all the DNA testing for the HPV strains.
Ooh.
Because the insurance wouldn't pay for it, and they couldn't identify any strain. And so the only thing that they figured out was that mine was probably related to secondhand smoke.
Wow.
And they were looking for squamous cell, and I went through the whole procedure and finally had the colonization. And the doctor called and said, way up in the deep, in the, you know, the farthest part of the cone tissue is where they found the adenocarcinoma.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
So I was completely asymptomatic. I went every year for a pap smear, and that's why I'm alive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what concerns me is the guidelines about if you have 3 years of a normal pap smear. You know, I'm concerned about other women who have adenocarcinoma being missed because I went from a class one to a class three in 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, so. And the deal is that all negative pap smears, screening tests are not perfect.
Right.
If you sent in 100 women who, unbeknownst to me, had cervical cancer, occult microscopic cervical cancer, the pap smear would pick up about 70% of them. So there are misses. And you're right, more frequent testing can find more cancers. But the problem is that we're causing a lot of harm in young women. So it's definitely a trade-off. It might be that a glandular cancer that would progress a little further if you had not had a pap smear the next year. Mm-hmm. And they've weighed these things. So So the ASCCP guidelines that came out, they had really thought carefully about, you know, the risks and benefits, and what we what they have not tried to do is set up a system that it, their goal is not to find absolutely every cancer, but the goal is to have very high find rates, very high cure rates, and do less harm. So, you know, and truly, you're right in the new paradigm, your glandular cancer could have been missed, which would be a miserable shame. But but so it's that whole trade-off thing that we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I really do understand that, you know, from the public health perspective and the prevalence. And I remember arguing with Dr. Lawson at the CDC about the guidelines. I used to run the breast and cervical health check program here. And I said, so basically what it is that people like me could get missed, you know. And it's a personal thing. But if I, you know, I was told at the time if I had waited till I was symptomatic that I would probably not have survived.
And the same thing is true in mammograms, you know. Do you do mammograms yearly or 2 years?
So, I mean, I think it comes down to sort of personal, you know, regardless of the guidelines, if there are people who really want to monitor their health carefully, that, you know, my recommendation to all my friends is to get an annual pap smear based on my own experience. And, you know, I don't like scaring people, and I know my cancer, what is it, less than 2% of cervical cancers or adenocarcinoma?
It's very small.
So, you know, but I'm lucky, and I'm alive because I had a pap smear, so that was my public health message.
Well, yeah, but try not to send all your friends in for too many pap smears, because you could cause some of them harm.
And I don't want to scare young women. I mean, I'm talking about people I talk to more my age who, you know, have had more partners and things like that. So I certainly don't want to scare people. But
you know, I think that's where though the HPV test will be a nice addition, because if the HPV is also negative.
And what was, you know, what was weird for me is I did aggressively pay for the test, you know, because I was trying to figure out where it came from. So the only thing that could come up for me was the secondhand smoke exposure.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Just a couple of seconds. You want to give us a quick reminder of what we want to listen to, remember from today?
You know, I'd put out an appeal for more Gardasil vaccines or Cervarix vaccines. It's not about who's a good girl or a bad girl. It's, you know, every life is valuable. We want to protect as many lives as possible. We're lucky in this country. We have to, we could argue about every pap smears every third year or every year. We're lucky to be here. We should make make use of every vaccine, and by golly, don't forget the men. The vaccine is approved for men as well.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, but women don't get that from walking down the street for the most all intents and purposes, and we need to now prevent men from getting these strains of this particular virus. Thanks for reminding us of that. Well, my thanks today to Anchorage gynecologist Dr. Tina Thompson. And I also want to say thanks also. We have one more email we did not get to, and I'm going to see if Dr. Thompson will answer that question about the lady who called in at 26 about her particular situation. So we'll see if we can get that answered for you offline. If you'd like to continue this conversation today about cervical cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook. Just go to alaskapublic.org. On the next program here in Anchorage, we're going to talk about the latest information on the prevention and treatment of HIV/AIDS, another very nasty viral infection, with Heather Davis of the Alaska AIDS Assistant Association and Dr. Beth Saltonstall of Alaska Native Health Consortium. So why not tune in to learn more and learn more next Monday? Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and also engineered today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.